Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Let's start this week with an email from Linda from Goose Creek, South Carolina. Dear Dr. Dawn, you addressed my husband's EKG change. He did 17 minutes on the treadmill, and his heart symptoms were just a few chest pains once in a while. He did do the dye test and another test. Turns out there is a 70% calcium blockage high up on the heart in the LAD vessel, where a stent can't be guaranteed to be placed exactly right due to the intersection of the vessels. He is 72 years old. Will it take another 20 years to get 90% blocked? Should he enjoy life as it is, or think about the bypass? If so, is robotic or the regular break the ribs the way to go? Appreciate your discussion. You are priceless. Well, thank you, Linda. And let's see. Let's take your questions one at a time. First of all, I'm thinking that there's a 70% calcified plaque, which means a narrowing of 70% at a point really kind of on the main part of the main road of heart, the left ventricle, which is the power part of the heart because it pumps the blood through the aorta and everywhere else, is fueled primarily by that left anterior descending artery. And there's little branches, but it's the trunk of the tree, right? And that's super important. Probably some of the other trunks or main branches are coming off. And so getting a stent in there is technically difficult. And the heart symptoms he had were just a few chest pains once in a while. So that's good. And it sounds like the other vessels were open. So this is one of those situations where stenting actually can do more harm than good. 70% is kind of right at the threshold where we think about stenting. And I think we've gotten a little stent crazy because it's snuck up on becoming the standard of care without it actually, in some of the cases that we stent where we find a blockage in people that's middling like this one, it's true. There's really no guarantee that there's an advantage, and there is a certain risk to doing a stent. There can be complications. There can even be death as a result of going in electively. Now, if a person is trying to have a heart attack, obviously that's an urgency, and we go in and do it because they've just proved that they need it by trying to kill off a part of their own heart. He's in one of those situations where he probably should think twice about getting stented. Will it take another year to get 90% blocked? Well, it might. But that's not really the question, because you're thinking about it as if it were a static pipe, right? And that the pipe is full of minerals and now it's only 30% open at this one spot. That's not wrong, but it's not the whole story. A calcified plaque is actually the better plaque to have. The calcified plaque is probably a stable plaque. Let me clarify that. When a plaque is growing rapidly, it's unstable. It's likely to crack or peel. And when it cracks or peels, that exposes collagen to the bloodstream. And immediately that sets off a coagulation response. So first, the platelets jump on the revealed calcium and they form a platelet plug. Now, if it happened at a 70% narrowing, it would probably block the entire artery and lead to a heart attack. But in a way, if it's calcified, it's less likely to peel or crack, ironically enough. It's more likely to cause angina, which is, well, just effectively a Charlie horse in the heart where it's not getting enough blood. That is treated with vasodilator drugs like nitroglycerin, the little pill that people put under their tongues. So he probably should be carrying that around. The option really is to stabilize any plaque that he's got that isn't calcified. And you can have a heart attack from 10% plaque. A lot of people don't realize that. If it cracks and you get a big platelet plug there, then yeah, you could have a heart attack with a very minor level of blockage and the more blockage, and especially the faster it's accumulating. So he would be a person where I would really think about going on either a statin or Repatha. And statin, of course, is a much cheaper and debatably safer drug. Statins can cause side effects, and anyone who's taking one needs to be taking at least 200 or 300 milligrams of CoQ10, because the action of the statin blocks an important enzyme, and it certainly can lead to heart failure after 20 or 30 years on a statin. But of course, by then you're older and nobody notices that you have low energy. The first stage of that is called diastolic dysfunction. I see that a lot. And that's where the heart isn't relaxing, but I digress. Getting back to your husband, this is a case where I probably would advise a patient of mine to be on a statin to prevent further additional plaque from forming anywhere else, because we don't want soft plaque to crack and cause a heart attack. Furthermore, it will probably slow progression of that blockage that he already has by reducing raw material for it. So I think it's a win-win. I'd also definitely have your husband get his carotids checked, because the left anterior descending isn't the only really important artery. And while we're looking at the heart and wondering what we should, scratching our heads, you know, there could be a big blockage in the carotid that actually does need to be stented. So let's get that checked out, and hopefully you won't find anything greater than 70% in either carotid. And that, by the way, is the threshold for stenting the carotid, because when you stent the carotid, you often cause microstrokes. So we don't do it lightly, and we don't do it unless there's quite a substantial blockage. Hope that helped. And now we're going to go to that caller. Hello, you're on the air. Tell me who's calling and where you're calling from.
Hi, this is Sibyl from Soquel.
Oh, hi, Sibyl.
Same old me.
Oh,
sorry.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, well, you know my story, Staph aureus and causing 3 major infections, osteomyelitis, sepsis, and infection in the eyes. And so I thought, because I was on 6 weeks of this antibiotic IV treatment, I knew somehow that I'm going to maybe have a side effect from this. And sure enough, I guess, you know, so long on an antibiotics can cause fungal or another bacterial infection.
Oh, would this be C. difficile that you've been diagnosed with? Clostridium.
Say that again.
Clostridium difficile. Does that sound familiar?
You mean the fungal infection?
No, I don't know. You tell me what kind of you said bacterial or fungal, and
no, I don't know the exact name, because they couldn't even tell me. I was looking it up, and they weren't specifically telling me which one. But it's a yeast. It's the yeast on. But here's this needs explanation. This needs explanation with the fingers. My fingers, you know, I never put a nail polish on because it doesn't look. I have roundish fingers. You know, they're round. They're not elongated. And all of a sudden, after this treatment, I have on 2 fingers, I think it's this antibiotics that did this, all of a sudden these 2 fingers are elongated. They're actually nice looking now. They're actually the nicest looking, fingernails that I have right now. But the cuticle, there's an entryway I see, and there's no cuticle. The cuticle is receding.
Hmm.
And so I that's why I have this infection. I clearly see the difference between these 2 fingers, just the little finger and then the next one next to it. And that's where I have the infection. And it's, how do I manage this? What should I do with these,
well,
with these fingers?
First of all, you need a definitive diagnosis. So have you gone to a primary care doctor or a dermatologist? And
yes, I mean, they did the culture, and all they told me is the yeast.
Okay. People can get yeast infections of the skin, and they will, they can infect the nail bed. The term for this is paronychia, and it's a chronic, mm-hmm. It can be a chronic infection. It's often associated with moisture, but not invariably. And I guess that being on a long-term antibiotic may have suppressed some of the, you know, I don't know this for a fact, but it may have suppressed some of your immune system with respect to antifungal. Depends on the antibiotic, and it depends on the individual. So first of all, I'm not seeing it, so I really can't tell you how to manage it. What suggestions did they give you? Did they give you any prescriptions, for example?
No, just a fungal cream. Fungal cream, and it seems like it's getting a little better. But the problem is, I feel like this can go on forever because, see, it changed my nails. It elongated them, and the cuticle is receding. Well, it's a total different looking nail now.
Yeah,
than
you know
before.
What, Sibel, I have to see this. All right, you know where my office is. You can come in.
Yeah,
and I have to. There's just no way you can describe it in a way that will make sense to me. I have to see it, and so you know that disclaimer I give at the beginning of the program is there are times when I just it's like, look, this needs a medical visit, and so this would be one. You know where I am. I'm over on Mission Street. I still do consultations, so you can call my office number. But I believe you have it, but it's 421-0197. And just talk to my, usually in the mornings, my receptionist is there and can pick up and give you an appointment, usually within a few days. I tend to do immediate booking, so I'm not the usual doctor where it takes forever to get in. And you've already, it would be fine. So, that would be my suggestion. Let me take a look, and then I might have some advice. Right now, I really don't know what to say.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Have a good one. Bye-bye.
Okay. So let's go to a memorial for an Australian man named James Harrison. You may have heard something about him over the last few days. He was the real man with the golden arm. That was a James Bond book by, I think, Ian Fleming. But this Harrison is credited with saving the lives of 2.4 million babies. Let me say that again. 2.4 million babies. Harrison had very special blood. How he got it, how he acquired it, we'll talk about in a moment. But he donated blood and plasma 1,173 times, beginning at the age of 18, as soon as he legally could give blood. 1,173 times. Now, in Australia, blood donors are not compensated financially, and his blood was very special, and it was special because of a compound it contained called anti-D. Anti-Rho is another word for it. And some of you have been a pregnant person and have been checked for the RH factor or Rho. And it's also known as rhesus disease, hence the RH. But the current term of art is hemolytic disease of the fetus and newborn. And this happens when the baby's blood has a compound on it that is the blood cells themselves have a marker. We call these HLA markers, and these are the blood typing markers. This is one where the mother doesn't have it. So her bloodstream makes antibodies against Rho. So what you do is you give an antibody to Rho to the mother at several places during the pregnancy because it covers up and hides that Rho antigen at critical moments during development when the mother's bloodstream and the fetus's bloodstream mix, and then it's given again at birth. And this prevents what's called RH sensitization. Well, when he was, I believe, about 14, our friend Mr. Harrison had to have a lung removed. He was very sick, and he stayed in the hospital for 3 months, and he had 3 gallons of donated blood. Now, somehow, his immune system got some antibodies against Roe, and about 10 years after he started donating blood, just to give back on general principle, scientists discovered that this anti-D treatment for hemolytic disease of the fetus and newborn was very effective. And all you had to do was find some anti-Ro. Well, he was a major source of that. And they took his blood, and he maybe something like 3 million doses of his blood have been given to Australian mothers since 1967. That also includes one of his own daughters who received a transfusion of anti-Ro from her father's blood so that she could have healthy children. And he, one of those healthy children, donated blood with him in the same Red Cross or whatever they call it in Australia, in the same blood donation center shortly before he retired. He had to stop giving blood at the age of 81, which is the maximum age for donation. So the most important thing here is that you can do something. Blood donations are at a substantial low. COVID kind of killed the habit for a lot of people, and people have not gotten the habit back. So, you know, what can you do in this time that would be constructive to maybe balance some of the destruction that's going on? Well, how about that? Besides, free cookies. A few helpful pointers: how to eat and drink fewer microplastics. By now, you've heard about them. And one of the things you can definitely do is don't drink bottled water. It's amazing how many particles of microplastic there are in bottled water. The average liter of bottled water contains about 240,000 particles. Oh, no. Oh, no. Tap water, even if it doesn't taste great, has a lot fewer microplastic particles and has higher surveillance in terms of contamination. Here's another one. Avoid plastic food containers. There are many ways to reduce your food's interaction with plastic. Plastic storage containers, out, out, out. Glass storage containers or stainless steel, in. When you buy food, try to buy food that comes in plastic containers. If you really want to be paranoid, and remember that the plastic particles have molecular motion. So when a container gets hot, a lot more plastic is going to dance into the food. Also, if a food is oily, plastic, because it is effectively a petroleum product, is oily. It will mix really nicely with it at the chemical level. So you're not even talking microplastic at this point. You're talking like the plastic molecules themselves popping into your cheese and into your peanut butter and into your mayonnaise. So yeah, glass weighs more, but it's completely recyclable. And so that's a plus. And it can be put to use, especially the big ones, as food containers for your fridge. So again, reuse, recycle. And here's another reason remember what I said about the plastic diffusing? This study came out of China recently, and they found that it was just a epidemiology study initially. They looked at about 3,000 people, and they found a direct correlation between heart disease and those who ate more frequently from plastic takeout containers. So they weren't sure if it was the food, you know, from the restaurant, or whether it was the plastic. So they exposed rats to the chemicals in the containers, very basic method. They poured boiling water into the boxes and then gave that water to the rats. And then they checked the rats' microbiome and their feces, and they found that the intestinal microbiome was altered. It became more pro-inflammatory, and there was more oxidative stress. And they found there was a direct dose relationship, but they also found that the rat's heart tissue appeared to have been directly damaged by one of the compounds. So use glass in the microwave. Take things out of their plastic containers, their plastic pouches, put them in a bowl. And there are a couple of other foods maybe you want to stay away from. And I was very surprised at this one. Coarse Himalayan pink salt and black salt had the highest concentration of plastic micro fragments of seven different salts that were analyzed. Iodized salt had the lowest. So I guess the girl in the yellow umbrella is making a comeback. And also those really cute little quote-unquote silk triangular plastic tea bags, those are plastic. They're plastic webbing, and they can release more than 11 billion microplastic and 3 billion nanoplastic particles in a single bag. So ditch those elegant, cool-shaped bags, because they are anything but good for you. And here's one that kind of blew my mind, and that was air fresheners. There are these scented wax melt air fresheners that are being marketed now, and they're a little disc of wax, and you put it in a very low temperature heater, and it perfumes your house. But these fragrance products actually lead to the formation of toxic nanoparticles at concentrations that could have significant health implications. Now, scented wax releases these particles, and unscented wax does not, although unscented wax, when you burn it, does release microparticles of carbon, which are carbon nanoparticles. It's the same stuff. But the things that are coming off of the scented things are terpenes, and these are complex aromatic compounds, and they react with ozone, and they create just a very high number of microparticles, especially small ones, which are going to get way down into your lungs. It is purely from the scent. And so from wax itself, of course, melting unscented wax is kind of like a futile process. But really, maybe just thinking about opening the windows and not trying to do quite so much to alter the scent. I do not know about diffusers, like essential oil diffusers, but I kind of think that even if you're using ultrasound to do the diffusing, I have not seen studies that don't say that you're not getting these microparticulates of the terpenes, and maybe we were just meant not to breathe those down deep into our lungs. Our next email comes from Mary in Texas. Mary writes, there's a new place in my neighborhood that offers cold water plunges and also also puts you in a refrigerator. It's supposed to be really good for losing weight. They say that there is scientific evidence for this. What do you think? Well, Mary, I have heard this before, that it raises the brown fat and helps you burn calories more, and that it has some anti-inflammatory effects. And so I went looking, and I found some studies that were short duration studies that showed physiologic changes along the lines I've just described. But I also found a very comprehensive systemic review and a meta-analysis that was done at the University of South Australia. And they analyzed 11 studies with over 3,000 participants, and they found that it has been extensively researched in the setting of helping athletes recover from injury. Well, we all know icing injury is helpful because it reduces inflammatory mediators. But they found that cold water immersion does reduce stress levels, and the effect only lasted for 12 hours post-exposure. But they also found that if you took like cold showers, they had 20, 60, or 90-second cold showers, and for the first few months, the people reported higher quality of life scores. And another study showed that there was a 30% reduction in sickness absence. But, you know, if I got sick, I wouldn't be taking cold showers. So there may have been some technical problems with that study in terms of selection. This study looked at, I mean, these cold water immersion studies where you're fully immersing the body in cold water or going into a refrigerator. Temperatures can be even sub-zero. Typically, they're 10 to 15 degrees Celsius. And cold water immersion does cause a temporary increase in inflammation, but then it causes a longer-term decrease. So essentially, you're causing an injury, and then the body turns off the injury, and you get a little anti-inflammatory overshoot. But very potentially dangerous for people with heart conditions, arrhythmias, older patients. And basically, the effect wears off. It's probably best to find another way to lose weight. And I think that once you buy the equipment for this place, you're naturally going to perhaps have a tendency to want to oversell. All right. Well, earlier tonight, we heard about demonstrations. We heard about speaking out. If you happen to go to one of those, I suggest that you make a sign saying, I demand H5N1 rapid testing kits now, because this is typically fiddling while Rome burns. All right. We are watching this tsunami. It's not here yet. We know it's coming. Every few weeks, somebody reports something. It's spread to a different animal. I've got the latest one for you. But what do we need? What do we need? We need testing kits. Hello. Why don't they make them and distribute them the way they distributed the COVID testing kits? This is going to be easily as bad when it finally becomes respiratory. Why aren't they stockpiling? At least make, you know, let's develop the kit now to the existing respiratory virus in, oh, let's say the one that's in cats, because, you know, it's a really good bet that this is that there is cat to human and human to cat transmission. It's very unusual. It's very rare. But cats get very sick from this. And they've just reported that it's finally in rats. Late January, the Agriculture Department added the black rat to the list of mammals that have bird flu. Now, cats frequently prey on rats. If they eat infected rats, we know that ingestion can cause H5N1. We think that people have actually given their cats the bird flu, the people who work in dairies and have exposure to infected birds. As if rodents are involved, it becomes much more likely that we're going to get respiratory spread, because rats produce really rapidly, and there's a lot of them, and they cluster together in, you know, burrows. So it's just the perfect storm here. We need rapid, accessible testing. We need to test anybody and everybody that has potential occupational exposure, and if we also need to test their households if they're positive. And those rapid antigen tests are cheap and they're easy to develop. And why don't we have them? Why aren't they being made? Now, this was the Biden administration was like, let's expedite vaccine development, and so they sent Moderna $590 million to work on a bird flu vaccine. Of course, Trump admin has said maybe they'll withdraw that funding because, well, why not? That's, you know, $500 million that could be given back to somebody who might buy an interest in Mar-a-Lago. Why would you remotely want to protect the population? Like I said, it would be nice to get that out there on some signs. So you can think about that. In the meantime, I have another comment. This is going to be maybe a little counterintuitive, but, you know, maybe we do need a new FDA because the FDA has been doing a really bad idea, a really bad job, I should say, under keeping food safe. So quick story. This happened in June of 2022. The FDA went to Stonegate Foods in Minnesota to investigate the production of a new ground beef substitute, kind of like one of those mega burger products, you know, made of vegetables and beet and lab-grown heme or whatever. But consumers of this particular product had reported abdominal pain, nausea, vomiting, fever, and fatigue, and they had elevated liver enzymes. And the biopsy showed drug-induced liver injury, which is surprising. So they investigated the heck out of this. They found no manufacturing problems, no contaminations. They looked for pesticides and mycotoxins and bacterial toxins and heavy metal. And it really just did have what was on the label. But after 400 people in 39 states fell ill and 130 were hospitalized, the investigators actually determined that a new ingredient listed on the label, tara flour, was the most likely cause of those injuries. In May of 2024, they completed an independent safety evaluation of tara flour, finding that it was not generally recognized as safe and there was therefore an unapproved food additive. So how did that get approved in the first place? Well, that's where you get this generally recognized as safe. Starting in 1958, the FDA was supposed to vet things for safety by the FDA before they were introduced into the food supply. But the law created an alternative pathway that permits manufacturers to bypass the FDA approval process. Substances that are generally recognized as safe aren't required to be vetted. Now, here's the problem. Then they changed the rules again, and under current new FDA rules, new as in the last decade, manufacturers may determine for themselves that a substance is generally recognized as safe. This GRAS was originally conceived as a designation that could allow common food ingredients like vinegar and baking powder, which had been in there forever in the food supply, but had never actually been scientifically tested and were very cheap. And rather than pulling them off while somebody tested them and then brought them back highly expensive, they decided to leave them there. But it's been increasingly having mission creep. So now it's things that perhaps were used traditionally in another culture, or things that have that are used to change the flavor or the texture or the shelf life, and it's bogus. Okay, the FDA changed put this voluntary process in 1997, and if a company voluntarily shares its GRAS determination, they can respond that it doesn't question the basis, it agrees, and or no, you don't have enough data. Even if the company withdraws a notification, the manufacturer may still introduce the new ingredient into the food. That's crazy. This isn't a safety rule. This is a government retirement plan, because in the FDA and the food industry and the drug industry have a revolving door. You leave the FDA, you get a job in the industry because, hey, that's where your expertise is. Well, your expertise is generally your connections. And believe me, the fix is in on this one. So, like I said, maybe we do need a shakeup at the FDA, because reading this article certainly shook me up. I'm going to give you a news of the weird, and it's really a weird one and just kind of astonishing. So let's talk about human language and evolution. We humans have about 20,000 protein coding genes, but only 23 of them produce proteins that are absolutely unique to humans. And a new study recently found that one of those, called NOVA1, changed dramatically between 250,000 and 500,000 years ago. Now, let me give you an analogy here for what I mean when I say a gene changed. Most of you have heard of APOE4, which confers an increased risk for heart disease and Alzheimer's. And the APOE4 gene is the old version. And then there was a new mutation. I don't know. Let's call it 500,000 years ago. That would probably be close. That is APO3. And then recently, a third variation on this gene, and they all work, but they just work a little bit differently, is the APO2. The APOE2 is actually the most protective gene if you are looking at risk for Alzheimer's, and the APOE4 is the riskiest gene to have. So we already know about these variations. Well, NOVA1 just basically took over between 250,000 and 500,000 years ago. This is not long after Homo sapiens split off from the Neanderthals and the Denisovans. And by the way, this new version, NOVA1, quickly overwhelmed the original variant in the human population. In fact, it's highly conserved. To this day, mutations that revert NOVA1 back to its earlier form are extremely rare in humans. So that, you know, they're scratching their head and they're like, I wonder what this gene does. So they genetically engineered mice to carry the human version of NOVA1 rather than the normal mouse variant, which looked more like what the Neanderthals were carrying around. And the mouse looked the same, but inside their brains, NOVA1 triggered the production of over 200 proteins that were not native to the rodents. Now, one gene does not code for 200 proteins, so this one gene was turning on other proteins. These proteins had the net effect of making the animal's vocalizations, the squeaks of the mice, richer and more complex. The modified baby mice had more complex and different calls when they saw their mothers, and the modified males had a different and more complex chirp when they saw a female in heat. So the co-author of the paper told Eric Jarvis, said he doesn't think it's the language gene because human communication evolved through hundreds of mutations over a million years, but this is probably one of the last steps that led to, our species essentially took over the playing field, right? The Neanderthals and the Denisovans died out. We crossbred substantially with the Neanderthals. Most of us have some Neanderthal DNA, but the point is, we had the secret sauce. We had complex communication. And complex communication led to the species dominance. What does complex communication get you? Well, A, it gets you the ability to accumulate information and transmit it over generations. And B, it gets you cooperation. And if there was ever a lesson for us to be looking at right now, it's that the way that we humans are awesome and great is through cooperation. And anything that gets in the way of that is actually lessening our species survival, not increasing it. So another hint for you, something healthy that you can be doing all the time, is moderate exercise. You've probably heard this. 150 minutes of moderate to vigorous exercise a week. That makes us think about having to figure out when we're going to go to the gym or play sports or run. But a new study published in the English Journal, researchers at Northeastern University asked 48 people ages 18 to 83 to dance for 5 minutes any way they wanted 4 times a day. The idea was to just get their heart rate up and they could put on their own music and dance around. So 4 5-minute bursts of what they called solo freedom dancing was fun, but it also had substantial benefits in terms of both compliance and also being able to get that 150 minutes in. So you might try this. It doesn't have to be continuous 20 minutes, right? It can be 4 5-minute breaks. I imagine that you could just take a slightly longer bathroom break, or put a few, if you're working at home, put a few post-it notes up and just go for it, turn it on. But maybe you don't want to use ear pods because headphones, especially the noise-canceling ones, may be damaging young people's hearing. Now, that's strange, right? So the noise-canceling headphones are hurting the hearing. They're not hurting the ear. They're hurting the brain. The technology effectively lowers the volume of distracting noises in loud places. It's a common feature in modern earphones. But there's mounting evidence that excessive use of this actually robs the brain of practice processing background noise. And this can lead to auditory processing disorder, in which a person can hear pure sounds just fine, but they can't, when they try to decode something complex and overlaid, perform essentially a Fourier transform in their head to decode the wave, they can't do it, or they can't do it well. Several hospital departments in the UK, they have seen rising numbers of young people coming in with this kind of auditory deficit. And researchers by SonarWorks, which is an audio tech company, found that about 50% of millennials don't listen to anything when they're wearing their headphones at work, 25% of Gen Z as well. The brains, essentially, they're doing the filtering with the headphone. They're not doing the filtering with their brain, and it's affecting their ability to process sounds and noise, both negatively, I mean, in terms of tuning it out, and positively in terms of tuning into it. So why would you use those headphones? Well, because there's distracting noise and you're having problems concentrating, but you're also not using your powers of concentration. You're basically letting that muscle in your brain or that function atrophy for want of practice. It's a use it or lose it situation. And who would have suspected that? I certainly find that very unexpected. What would a Dr. Don show be without a story about the microbiome? Not nearly as good. So our microbiome story this week is about researchers who have created a synthetic microbiome. Well, it's not lab-created bacteria quite yet, but let's walk through it. It's a synthetic microbiome therapy that they've tested in mice for protecting against Clostridium difficile, which is a bacterial infection. And typically the organisms in the microbiome kind of balance and keep each other in check. And some of the probiotics act sort of, think of it as mulch to keep the weeds down. Many people carry C. difficile in their gut, but it doesn't cause a problem. However, if they take antibiotics, particularly if they take them for a long time, like one of our early callers tonight, it creates an environment where C. difficile can flourish by knocking out the good bacteria along with the harmful ones, because C. difficile is very, very drug resistant. So most antibiotics don't kill it. So you get a bloom, like an algae bloom. Or imagine what happens if all of your mulch goes away, the weeds get some sun and a little water, and it's off to the races. And weeds grow fast. C. difficile does a very good job of dominating the gut. It causes 500,000 infections annually in the United States, and is associated with $1.5 billion in healthcare costs annually. And that therapy, fecal microbiota transplant, which does work, well, it's hard to get enough stool to treat all of the people who could use it. And we have to be careful that we only use the highest quality poo, because otherwise we could transmit diseases along for the ride with the good bacteria that come along from the microbiome donors. This new synthetic microbiome uses fewer but more precise bacteria strains that have been linked to C. difficile suppression previously. And what the team did was they decided, instead of a random mix of bacteria from a quote-unquote healthy donor, couldn't they identify the microorganisms that are best able to suppress C. diff? So they went through 12 previously published studies, and these were highly scientific, had microbiome sequencing data, and they found 37 strains of bacteria that were negatively correlated with C. diff. In other words, when these microorganisms were present, there wasn't a C. diff infection, and they found another that seemed to be helpers and were positively correlated with C. diff. So they combined the 37 bacteria and grew them up, creating a synthetic fecal transplant, and they gave that to mice, and it worked. It reduced growth of C. difficile, helped the mice resist infection, and was just as effective as a human fecal transplant in mice. While they were doing this, they found that there was one particular bacteria that was critical for suppressing. And so they decided, well, let's go back and see if this one alone will do it. And indeed, this particular strain of the rather, I like this because it sounds like it belongs in a children's book, Peptostreptococcus. So in Peptostreptococcus, if you've got that particular strain, it is a potent suppressor of C. diff. So now we don't quite know why. They think it's because this particular Peptostreptococcus likes to eat proline, an amino acid, which C. difficile absolutely needs to grow. I think we talked a few episodes ago about bile acid, secondary bile acids, and their importance in the gut. That was thought to be critical for resisting C. difficile and may indeed be important. That's when the bacteria, your good bacteria, ferment your bile and turn it into something different that is critical for resisting C. difficile. Could be both things. Could be that there are multiple factors, as there usually are, but we are on our way to we're on the way to at least weaponizing bacteria very specifically using machine learning to identify what's going on. It's very exciting, and I'm very pleased to report it to you. So another one I'm pleased to give you some good news here is that the Center for Vaccine Development at the University of Maryland School of Medicine has just announced that they have a working oral norovirus vaccine tablet. It's still unapproved, so it's got the product naming people will have to go after this one hard. It's VXA-G1.1-NN. Anyway, it's safe and well-tolerated and elicits a robust systemic response that's in the bloodstream and also a mucosal response, which when you're talking about norovirus, a diarrheal disease that causes 70,000 hospitalizations in the United States and up to 800 deaths, and this is even more expensive, $10.6 billion per year. This study was looking at older adults. They had 65 people aged 55 to 80, and they gave them either this vaccine or placebo. So they gave them doses 28 days apart, and then they followed them for 210 days. They measured serum IgA and IgG responses, and they remained elevated for that 210 days. They also found that these antibodies were functional. They could block norovirus from infecting cell culture, so they had what we call neutralizing potential. And the salivary and nasal IgA concentrations also increased and remained elevated. So you're usually getting this as an aerosol. When people vomit, the virus aerosolizes and remains in the air for a long time, so you can get sick. It's rather like measles. in that respect, something else that we're going to talk about. So I would expect, since we don't have a good vaccine for norovirus, this is real good news. And they already tested it in younger people and found it worked. And it worked just as well in people from, 55 to 80. So there's no attenuation of the response with age, which is, really, really good news. So we'll spend a minute or two talking about the truth about vitamin A in measles and a little comment about birth defects. First of all, let's talk about the difference between measles in a healthy, well-nourished child in the United States, including one who's unvaccinated, and measles in an unhealthy, undernourished child with multiple vitamin deficiencies. This first segue is to, in a situation of malnutrition, the vaccines don't work as well. The children do not mount as strong an antibody response, and the vaccine doesn't last as long. And even vaccine in displaced persons camps, won't work as well. So you want you've got your natural experiment, because measles is now making a strong comeback in world parts of the world where there are displaced populations, and particularly bad in children who are stunted. So we've known for a long time that in that population, if they get measles and are hospitalized, that vitamin A is very helpful in preventing the complications, which are pneumonia and, among other things, blindness. And of course, vitamin A is the vision vitamin. So, you take a kid who's already not great in that department and give them measles, and you're going to have higher rates of blindness as a result of the neuroinflammation. But our new health cabinet secretary is focusing on vitamin A. They actually changed the website on Friday. CDC added a section on vitamin A, saying that the supplement may be given to children under the supervision of a healthcare provider. It also mentions that inappropriate dosing can lead to hypervitaminosis A. This is one of the vitamins where more is not better. But the website does not give dosing. It does give dosing recommendations. I take it back. I misread that. But you want to be really careful with vitamin A, particularly, I will add, if you are a pregnant woman or thinking about getting pregnant, because vitamin A at the dose, for example, that you might find in Airborne, which is a vitamin A product that's supposed to take when you get on an airplane to keep you from getting a cold. Lots of people take it when they get cold. Really not good for at the doses recommended on the package, which is 8,000 units 3 times a day. You could actually potentially cause a birth defect with that dose. So women need to be very careful. Maybe take beta carotene instead of vitamin A. Most importantly, it doesn't prevent measles. There's no data at all. It prevents complications of measles, but it's not going to prevent measles. And the child that died in Texas was not a sick child. It was a healthy child. It was a 6-year-old with no medical problems. That 1 in 1,000 deaths from measles. Yeah, it happens. That's the data for the healthy kids, right? That's the healthy kid data. That healthy kid data comes from 1963, when 400 to 500 kids died every year under the age of 5. We really do not want to see measles make a comeback. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.